Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us. And we will continue that series with the UMBC students tomorrow at 10 a.m. and all during the course of the week as we hear this incredible work that they have done on gentrification in our city in that one district, Bromo-Seltzer Arts District. We're now joined here by a panel to kind of really wrestle with where we are in this country, why there seems to be such violence, what is our love affair with violence and the gun, how is it tied to our past, how is it tied to, in some ways, very conservative religiosity and more, and maybe conservative politics, and maybe not just that, but and why have there been 355 what we call mass shootings of four more people in this country in the 337 days that we have had on this year's calendar. I think I have that date right. But anyway, it's many. And many of those shootings, by the way, for our local listeners here, happened in Baltimore. At least three of the ones I've counted up, of the shootings of four more people at one time, have happened here in the streets of Baltimore, in our poorest neighborhood. So we are joined by Dr. Maricela Gomez, physician and community activist, author of Race, Class, Power, and Organizing in East Baltimore, Rebuilding Abandoned Communities in America, the Reverend Todd Yeary, senior pastor of the Douglas Memorial Community Church, Joshua Holland, who is contributing writer to The Nation, a writing fellow with The Nation Institute, host of Politics and Reality Radio, author of the article, America is Fine with Mass Shootings as Long as They're Not Perpetrated by Muslims, and Dr. Daniel Webster, who is director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research and deputy director for research at the Johns Hopkins Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence. Good to have you all with us and welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Please call in with your comments and ideas at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Comment on our Facebook page or email us to talk@steinershow.org. Again, 410-319-8888. 8888. So before let's jump into this, I'm going to go right to you, Daniel Webster, just to lead off, because I know you only have a couple minutes with us here and wanted to get your thoughts out. And when we look at the prevention of violence in the society, I mean, there's a lot of people now beginning to have a conversation at last about why we as Americans seem to be such a violent culture. When you read what's being read in the French press, when you read what's happening in the British press and press in different parts of the piece I read in Nigeria and the rest, people are kind of alarmed. What is it about our culture that lends itself to this kind of violence? What does your research say?
Right. So that's an excellent question. There is no doubt, of course, that we are a violent culture by a number of different dimensions. But I think when it comes to gun violence and lethal violence, we really stand out. What if this was purely a problem of something about American society and culture that was generated more violence, then our rates of violence that don't involve guns would be very substantially higher than in other high-income countries. What we find, however, is that on just about any measure of violent aggressive behavior or even risk factors for violent aggressive behavior, we are pretty much in the middle of high-income Western democracies, but our rate of homicide is roughly seven times higher than the average of those countries. And that's principally due to the fact that our rate of gun homicides is 19 times higher, 19 times higher than the average. So I don't want to make a claim that the only reason we have high rates of homicide is because we've failed to adequately control guns, but undoubtedly that is a very central piece of the puzzle and should be part of the solution so that we can aspire to be average. We always talk about American exceptionalism. The only way we're exceptional when you compare us to violence with other high-income nations is our rate of lethal violence, and it's completely a function of wide availability of guns due to what I would say are typically very intentional gaps in our gun laws to minimize accountability for anyone selling a firearm.
And Joshua Holland, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us here. I've been enjoying your writing, so I'm glad you could take some time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
One of the things that I know that you wrote about in the last article that you put in The Nation that was is that A, we kind of look at these violent occurrences in America, these mass shootings in America, but it really only this last one seems to have tipped off this major push to, because it was a couple that were of Islamic faith who did it. So it tipped off a different way of looking at this, even though they are at the very bottom of the numbers of people in our culture who perpetrate this kind of violence. And B, you kind of also wrote about the numbers of laws that were passed in this country to make it easier to obtain guns and how that contributed to what we're seeing today. And they're tied.
Yeah, I cited the Mother Jones. They've done studies on the number of states that have relaxed their gun laws since 2009. I think it's 37 states. And it's striking to me the difference in the media's reaction, in the political class's reaction to kind of what we consider the humdrum of mass shootings, these kind of more routine bloodbaths, and terrorism. And, you know, there's obviously a media effect. We tend not to perceive threats in a way that corresponds with how great they actually are statistically. So, you know, you can think about when the movie Jaws came out, for example, everybody stayed away from the beaches. They were afraid to go swimming. And, you know, your likelihood of getting eaten by a shark is exceedingly remote. And it's the same kind of thing with terrorism. In the United States, at least, you're more likely to be struck dead by lightning than to die in a terror attack. But if you turn on the TV and you flip between, you know, MSNBC and CNN and Fox, you see just a steady drumbeat of horrifying stories. And there is a threat amplification process that goes on with this. So there really is a huge difference in the way we perceive these kinds of attacks.
You know, one of the things, there's all these connections here. I was thinking about the thing Daniel said a moment ago about the rest of the world being as violent in many ways as America, and humankind has always been violent. This is not an American phenomenon nor invention. But there is a violence here that takes place. When I look at police forces in Western Europe, the cases of brutality and attacks are not as severe. The numbers of killings, obviously, because of fewer guns in the suburbs of color in Paris are not as they are in our poorest communities in America. There is a difference.
Well, I don't think that exists in a vacuum, and I certainly don't want to defend police departments in a blanket sense. But one has to be aware of the fact that not only do American police kill more citizens than police in any other developed country, they are also killed at a much higher rate, and they're facing a heavily armed population. So as a police officer, and again, I'm not trying to defend anybody, but when you go out on the street, you know that you are facing a population with a rate of gun ownership. I think it's we own more than one gun per person in this country, I believe is the statistic. If you look at a place like the UK, when you're going out to police the streets in the UK, you know that you're facing a population that owns 6 guns per 100 people. It's a completely different situation, right? So you can't say that it's that these things aren't related.
Mark, I think a couple of things come to mind. One is the role that violence has played in the telling of the American story. That at the root of the foundation of the nation has been a propensity to use violence for means that are self-serving and at the expense of communities that are in many ways disposable or dispensable. The other challenge is when we look at this 21st century availability, this notion that somehow or another the government is out to get me, creates this kind of paranoia in the general populace that says that the only way I can defend myself against a government that might be somewhat tyrannical is to go stockpile guns, ammunition, and water. Remember when no one was sure if the computers would make it past January 1 of 2000.
People
were setting up shop in their basements and in their storm cellars waiting to see what the outcome, because gloom and doom was upon us. And so I think there are a number of factors. One, it is part of our historical profile that whenever the country does not get what it wants, force and violence is the mechanism by which they get cooperation or conciliation. That carries over to the general populace. You learn what's modeled for you. I think the other problem is when you look at the communities where we've talked about policing. Let's not miss the fact how policing emerged in the United States. It was to make sure that folks basically stayed in their place. If you did not remain tied to the geography that was set apart for you, then it was on one hand public safety, on the other end it was slave patrols. And so out of that, this notion that you can use whatever force is necessary creates this sense of being unsafe amongst populations that often leads to this ramping up of more and more violent responses to this emerging terror threat. The other part is that we have an interesting scapegoat now from this past episode, but still by far, I was on Northern Illinois University's campus on Valentine's Day in 2008 when there was a mass shooting on that campus, 5 people killed in a building about 250 yards from my classroom, and we were actually the place, the safe space where many students ended up coming. That in this process, domestic terrorism is still the issue that we don't want to talk about because we always have to have an other as our enemy. And until we confront kind of the reflection in the mirror about this this preoccupation with guns and violence and the like, I think we're going to continue to have these kinds of issues.
So I know that in a couple of minutes, Daniel, I want to turn to Maricela, but I know that, Daniel, you have to leave in a couple of minutes. So I'm going to parry off of what Todd Yeary just said and ask you to reflect on something for a moment before I turn to Maricela. You just returned from South Carolina, and I'm really very curious about your thoughts about what happened there when you were in South Carolina and at the church. Could you talk a bit about that?
Sure. There was a gathering at the AME Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, roughly around the 6-month anniversary of the tragic shooting in that house of worship, and it was a wonderful, affirming event, in my opinion. It was a very diverse group of individuals who came together. Some from other places, like myself, so-called experts, but more important was that the church was filled with community members of all stripes and a firm commitment that they would not let some of the cultural issues get in their way of actually addressing this problem. When I say the cultural issues, I'm not only talking about race, which was a factor, of course, in that shooting, but also cultural issues around guns. I think one of the hurdles that we have to get over, that's no small hurdle, is a tribalism sort of approach that some in the Republican Party have really cultivated, so that we can't even have a conversation about common sense ways to make our communities safer from gun violence, because it is seen as an assault on a culture to have minimal, basic regulations on guns. So it was a very open forum, and I walked away quite enthused about their commitment to change, recognizing that it's a long struggle.
Daniel Maricela, I want to thank you for the work you do and appreciate you taking the time with us today, and we look forward to having you on for a longer time soon.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Thank you so much for being here. We're going to have a very quick break. We'll be back with Dr. Maricela Gomez, the Reverend Todd Yeary, and Joshua Holland, and really kind of tackle why there are so many mass shootings in this country and killings. What does it say about us? How do we tackle that problem? And where do we go? And how do we do it without getting into an Islamophobic fervor? Stay with us. here with the Reverend Dr. Todd Yeary, Senior Pastor of Douglas Memorial Church. Joshua Hallam, contributing writer for The Nation, where he just wrote, America is fine with mass shootings as long as they're not perpetrated by Muslims, is a writing fellow with The Nation Institute and host of Politics and Reality Radio. And Dr. Maricela Gomez, physician and community activist, author of Race, Class, Power, and Organizing in East Baltimore, Rebuilding Communities in America. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So let me just come right to you and kind of hone in on this idea of the mass shootings in our country, and a huge amount. 355 times where four more people were shot or killed in the United States is a huge number. And we were talking during the break about America and our love affair, our need to own weapons.
Yes, I like we were saying at the break, is we have a culture that has justified the need for the use of this thing called a gun. As I was reflecting on myself just now, is I've thought of maybe I need to have a gun. Where I live and work in East Baltimore, the culture, the context is one of gun violence. And so when you at night at 11 o'clock, maybe the only thing that can protect you is a gun. But I think, and I don't have a gun. And I'm not going to have a gun.
You don't intend to buy one, right?
No, I don't intend to have one. But what justified me to think that I needed a gun? Well, what justified me was that this is the only thing that can actually protect my safety, that can make sure I can stay alive in this interaction with someone who would have a gun. So when you're in a society where the gun is the norm, and when in particular contexts or situations or conditions where the gun is the norm as a means of defending yourself, then it pushes you to think that that's what we should have. And then you just increase the amount of guns that people start using. I was reflecting on this great piece that just came out, Christopher Dickey in the Daily Beast, where he reflects on Charles Dickens' feeling about America and guns, and how he felt that it was a cowardly practice for a country to support the use of guns in its need to defend its right to own slaves. And he makes a connection that the U.S. right to own guns came with the right to own slaves. And I think this is really the crux of it, right? I'm thinking myself as of owning a gun because I feel like it's the only way I can protect myself. When people had the right, and this was white people in America, to own a gun, they felt the justification was in order to protect themselves against the unorderly conduct of the black man. I mean, the whole slave patrol was based on making sure that you maintain a group of people to be subservient. And the only way you could do that then was to have something that you felt would allow you protection of your life against this group of people. And I think that the impetus of the back then, the reason we decided that guns was the way to go and the violence that comes from it was predicted back then in the 1800s. I mean, there's something that Dickens said that nothing good will come of this. This will result in violence that we won't even be able to understand. And so here we are in the 21st century, and we're doing exactly that, where more people own guns now. We have taken that understanding that the only way to take care of myself, protect people I love, my mm-hmm. right, is to own something that will cause harm to someone. Why? Because if not, they will use that same element, that same tool, that same weapon to cause harm to me. Unfortunately, it's not a stick. Unfortunately, it's a weapon that when it's used will take your life. So really, it's about violence. It's about violence and defense. And I think if we really wrestled with that, our understanding of that, and then bring it right home to who owns a gun in just down the street in their home, sitting around a table having whatever, chicken and fries or, you know, rice and beans. I think if we just look at what we would be willing to do, if we would be willing to own a gun, depending on where we were, I think we'd the discussion would get a little bit more real.
Todd, please leave in the middle of somebody, Joshua.
Well, I think all of that is the consideration. I think the pretext that gets to the consideration of why you need the gun is how do you exercise some sense of control over your person and your environment? Mm. And so there, I think there are two contexts that kind of contrast a bit. One is this fear amongst the conservative side, let's say white gun-toting, you know, shotgun, you know, teach my kid, that kind of thing, that I'm worried about how the government's going to use the military against me. Against urban communities and people of color, the concern is how is the paramilitary going to be used against me? Those are called police forces. And when we see in the replay of what's going on in the national spotlight right now, what happened in Chicago, where the use of a force of violence like a gun 16 times on a body is played out and now you get to see it, it then creates an image and a concern in the general populace that raises the question, if the force that should be protecting me is out to kill me, I now must take matters into my own hands to protect myself.
So then, Josh, let me ask you this question. So if this is this kind of potential warfare grows exponentially, right, with the fear in this country,
right, mm-hmm,
then what is our response to that? I mean, and how do you create a societal response when it's also, you know, that people arm themselves because they think the government's a threat, as we said, and that happens. People arm themselves because you're afraid people are going to come through your door. People arm themselves because we have to sell our wares on the corner, and I'm going to make sure I got mine. You can't take it from me. We have gone into this kind of.
Oh, it's a spiral.
Yeah,
yes, exactly. And it's gone from the individual level to the mass level, community level, country level. So we're out of control, right? Because you're right. When you see a young man being shot for no apparent reason that any intelligent person can understand by a police officer, you really see that it's really out of control right now, right? We're completely out of control. The people who have the right to bear arms in this country and use it at will with their good intention, they are not being policed themselves. They have now taken that oath and that supposed means to justify to defend themselves to a completely different level. And it's on a mass scale because that's the government. And there's no remedy to it because they don't become punished. So we have, if we really take this thing apart and deconstruct it, we have to look at all the elements that are resulting in violence in the different places. You know, we kind of lump gun violence into one, but certainly I think we have to take it apart. We have to look at policing. This is a huge factor in our communities.
But let me just read this one piece and turn to Joshua Holland and make a comment here. I mean, Ethelbert Miller, who's a poet and a writer and a dear friend, wrote this piece and sent it to a few of us this morning. And in one of the lines he wrote, when did gun violence become confused with terrorism? Should we all carry suicide belts too? So you can't find a gun, but you know how to build a bomb. What's an NRA member to do? How do we climb out of this mess? Before we return to the Middle Ages and battles between warlords, evangelicals, let's prepare ourselves for the inevitable, which is often too irresistible. As I keep mentioning, in the 21st century, the problem is religion. Also, we are seeing the return of tribalism and the failure of the nation state, which is what my friend, the poet Ethelbert Miller, just wrote this morning. Joshua?
Oof, well, there's a lot to unpack there. You know, I would caution that, you know, there's a great deal of diversity within religious groups, and that's true of Islam just as it's
absolutely
true of Christianity and Judaism. And we tend to think of there's this thing called Islamic culture, and all too often we have a picture of that that's based on how religious leaders behave in Saudi Arabia or Pakistan or Afghanistan. The reality is that the America's Muslim community is, and I know this is counterintuitive in the wake of such a grisly attack as we saw in San Bernardino last week, but it's incredibly well integrated. It is. We do not have a radicalization problem. It's considered to be the wealthiest Muslim community in the world. This latest attack was the 24th time a Muslim American has committed a terror attack in the last 14 years. They've killed grand total now of 64 people out of 200,000 murders in that time. So, you know, just to put the issue in perspective, I want to point out one other factor, and that is the gun lobbies. And I think this is very intentionally done, the fantasy of a heroic gunslinger that will save the day. This is, you know, you see surveys that show a majority of people who own guns say that they own guns for their own protection, for self-defense. And the reality is that all of the empirical studies show that more guns only leads to more violence, right? Because there's this idea, if you talk to, you know, NRA flacks, they'll say, well, you know, we need good guys with guns. This is something that they kind of lionize, this idea of a good guy with a gun. And the idea is if you go through the process to get a legal permit, you must be a stable and responsible person. And it just doesn't work that way. When you say we need more people carrying guns, you're saying we need more people who have impulsive anger issues with guns. We need to have more people who, you know, get into road rage incidents carrying guns. And it's a very dangerous fantasy that's very, very widespread among gun owners that they're going to, you know, save the day. They're going to be the action hero. It just doesn't work like that in real life.
So how important is it for us to wrestle with how we easily we access guns? And addressing that issue in America, how important is that juxtaposed with, it is important to discuss both or not, where it comes from in us?
Well,
is it simple enough to say we have to ban the guns, we have to kind of make it much more difficult to buy them, we produce less of them? Do we also have to wrestle with why we are the way we are, or are they separate issues?
Well, there's two interlocking issues there, right? Because, first of all, we are unique in that we consider gun ownership to be a right and not a privilege, and that makes it extremely hard to address the issue at its root. You know, we can regulate cars. We do regulate car ownership much more than we do gun ownership, and a big reason for that is that we consider driving a privilege, that you can lose your privilege, and it's much harder with guns. The reality is that you need some sort of due process to deny somebody the right to bear arms. That's the legal situation according to the Supreme Court right now. But the issue of access is huge, and I think it's important to point out that you know, the number of households that own guns has declined dramatically in the last 40 or 50 years. It used to be, in the 70s, about half of American homes had a firearm. Now it's down to 31%, I believe. So you're seeing fewer people owning more guns, and it's just, I think that there's a mentality that we have to think about. I don't know how you address that gun culture, but I think it's a significant part of the problem, this culture that says, and it goes back to that paranoia about the government, about staving off tyranny, about holding your guns to keep, you know, I don't know, King George at bay. And this is something that's very hard to address.
Yeah, I agree that we have to look at the issue of the guns, right? Because it's an issue, it's available. But what we're looking at also is the way we as human beings in community or in organizations address our difficulties. If we have community, again, let's look at some of our communities that have really high crime rate. These communities are really fragmented. So there's already been a systematic way that community has been treated and fragmented and left to deteriorate. The way this community might address some of their grievances or the way that they may work out differences is going to come a very different way, because communities have been left to self-absorb. They haven't been provided resources. They haven't provided education and all the other things that we might be able to use to access equity. So what comes into their hands? The whole process of criminalization, a way to deal with things in our high drug use areas. The gun is what we access in order to settle a dispute. You know, I always tell people, and I don't want to minimize the effect of violence of guns, is that the way executives in corporations, especially in these very high wheeling dealing corporations where lots of monies are at stake, the way they backstab each other, the way they treat each other in very violent ways, not with a gun, no, but with different means, the way they take care of their business is very different than, say, the way the guy on the corner selling dope takes care of his grievances. He takes care of his grievances with a gun. It's a different way of addressing. And I bring this up to say that violence exists in all of us. The tendency to take care of ourselves, to protect ourselves, as you said earlier, to take care and support our home, our family, our hearts, what's in our hearts, right? That's normal. That's a good thing. The fact is that how we do it, where we have access to it, who has easy access to it. Also, who gets exploited when they use it? Because, it's bringing the whole criminalization of mass incarceration. Who uses a gun and who gets penalized for it? So I agree that guns is the issue here, but I also think that we have to look up more. It goes to the question you asked, is what else is going on here? What else is there about us as human beings in society? What else is there about the systems that have created such fragmentation in our communities amongst ourselves that we feel the only, why am I thinking about getting a gun? Because I'm in a community that's so fragmented that the way it deals with its issues is with violence using a gun.
I think the question, though, is how do we learn to cope with despair and desperate situations? Very often when I feel threatened, and threat is not necessarily a sign of some illness, it's a very real human trait, that how I respond to it is often learned behavior. So if we look at post 9/11, remember, after everybody sees the images of the towers coming down, the government's response to protect us was to put air marshals on select airplanes. And so now what you have is supposedly highly trained people with armed weapons on the plane. The problem is you don't know who they are and whether or not they are the ones to protect you if something were to happen on the plane. That the response very often is to give the image that the way you protect yourself against the ultimate violent act is through the use of a firearm. The other thing is we can't leave off the table the economic impact of gun sales in this country. $43 billion in terms of annual gun sales generated by way of revenue. And so when you tie this economic argument that there is some sort of altruistic benefit of being able to sell these guns, in the vast majority, you hear these, you see these conflicting statistics. Gun violence is going down, but yet you're seeing these mass shootings kind of take place on a more common basis, at least in terms of the awareness of the general population. The real question is, what's really going on here? And I think at the root of it is, not only do we need to control the ease of access, so you're not going to ban guns. I think everybody needs to just put that on the table up front, that that's not going to be feasible. I don't think there's any Supreme Court configuration that would say that they're going to undo the Second Amendment to the Constitution. So how and in Chicago, remember, Chicago used to have an outright ban about who could own guns in the city. And the Supreme Court, and by way of its rulings, that's beginning to change right now. So I think we got to look at what are the other options. And I think the options are reasonable points of access and information that would help with the screening process. That's always the big argument. And so here's the counter. Well, they would have passed the background check because most of the information is self-reported, which is actually true. So the question becomes, how do we get to the root causes of the despair that creates a sense of vulnerability where I feel threatened enough to need to protect my person by way of a violent means? And that violent means is easily accessible as a gun. We've got to get to the root that's leading us here and understand that there is a money mechanism tied to it. And unless you're going to resolve that, you're going to have an uphill battle on this gun access.
Josh, you want to tell on that one?
We have an intractable problem, and really there's a massive problem with political will, and it really comes down to that at the end of the day.
Political will. I mean, this is so wrapped up in some ways with who we are and why we want think we need these guns yeah. around us all the time. That's you know, right. And, it, sure. And it and it and so it's you know, I can remember the stories. I can remember as a young civil rights worker. We've talked about this many times before. Mm-hmm. I won't belabor it again. But
it's your story. Tell it.
No. But we were all. But we were nonviolent when it came to confronting segregation in this state and the South, and got our butts beaten mm-hmm. and jailed and mm-hmm. and more. But when we went back to the Freedom House at night, or when we were driven from place to place, there were guns under every seat we were driven in. In every car that we took,
yeah.
there was a gun under the front seat.
There's a difference between nonviolent and antiviolent.
So what I'm saying is it's pervasive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's so difficult to kind of, I think, put our hands around this, because it's pervasive for so many different complex reasons.
Well, it's the currency, right? What is the currency of self-protection? What is the currency of taking care of your home and your family? The currency is a gun. So as long as our currency for that is equal to a gun, then it's on the table. And I find it interesting that you say that let's just forget the idea that we're ever going to outlaw guns. I don't think we should do that yet. I don't think we're there yet. I mean, honestly, as human beings,
that outlawing guns is you think it's still a reasonable option in terms of the political will?
I think it's a human option. I think it's a human option, because I think once we say that that's not going to ever change, we're saying that we're okay with the currency of self-protection being a means that results in death. Now, whatever happened to the days where you can get punished and you can be rehabilitated so you won't do that thing again?
But
whatever
right,
happened to the understanding as human beings
but
that
the right
we can
to self
be trained
protection by
to
way
take
of
care
a
of
gun,
ourselves?
You take the gun off the table, you substitute it with another instrument by which that self-protection is actually executed. I think what we're talking about is the mechanism by which self-protection happens. The reason I say it's going to be difficult to accomplish is because in the constitutional authority that everybody holds on to, that political will is a huge uphill battle, and I don't see the swing in communities around the country sufficient enough by the process that is currently in place to get that altered anytime soon.
Let me, Joshua Holland, bring you right back in just to talk, expand a bit more on that political will then.
Well, I just want to point out that there's a lot that we could do short of banning firearms, right? I mean, the background check system is completely broken. We hear everybody talking about closing loopholes. The reality is that the standards by which we can deny someone a permit to have a weapon are insufficient. That, you know, you basically need to be diagnosed with a severe mental illness. The reality is that only a very small percentage of perpetrators of gun violence have been diagnosed with a serious mental illness. So we hear all these dodges. Well, we need to look at the mental health care system. We need to look at the legislative process that has produced such poor regulations. And when I talk about political will, you know, this is a classic thing where we think about the intensity of views. Gun control advocates always mention that 90% of Americans favor closing the gun show loophole, or, you know, 80% of Americans favor laws requiring trigger locks, whatever those numbers are. But the bottom line is that you have a very well-organized, very strident, very vocal minority that are gun rights absolutists, that, you know, will go a lot further for their views than those of us on the other side will. And when you have such an inequality of intensity of views, that makes an issue politically very, very difficult. Then you have the gun lobby, and they have a lot of resources that they throw at lawmakers. It's a very sticky situation. Having said that, I think that there is certainly growing awareness of the scope of the problem, and there are efforts. You know, there's efforts to build infrastructure on the gun safety side. Certainly, former Mayor Bloomberg has put in $1 billion into this effort. There's a variety of new organizations that have propped up in the last few years to advocate for gun safety laws. So it's possible that we will see the kind of the tide changing in the next couple of years.
Closing thoughts here, we're just about out of, but we have a few more minutes here, and I think our phones are now working, so we'll get you the next hour, 410-319-8888, to get in this conversation. But I mean, to kind of close it out here, this is, a lot has been said, we haven't kind of gotten any concrete idea, concrete thoughts about how to address this, but I think there, because I think that's this, it's part of the political impasse of this nation, and part of it, I think, is also wrapped up in this last 15 years in America. From 9/11 to Katrina to Obama becoming president to the divide being sharpened and deepened and the expose of the depth of racism, all that comes to play here, making it kind of difficult, not an easy thing to say, yes, here is the solution to what we face.
Well, my two closing comments would be, yes, we need to regulate better because certainly not in my lifetime will it be banned. But I think it's a higher ideal to rise toward. And then the other one would be, we need to do something about the vast disparity, the sense of hopelessness that exists currently in our society, particularly by those who have always been left behind, but also by those who have come into that mix.
And we had 30 seconds.
Well, I think that's the root of it, that what leaves folks feeling vulnerable and needing to defend themselves is, what's the threat? Where's the threat coming from? In the interim, I think more extensive use of the procedures by which you can purchase a gun, the process of vetting needs to be strengthened. At least at that point, I think you may not catch all that would otherwise fall through the cracks, but I think you can begin to catch some.
I wish we had more time today, but we don't. We'll come back to this. Clearly, there's a lot to wrestle with here. First of all, Joshua Holland, I've enjoyed your writing for a while. I'm glad to have you on the show. I appreciate you taking the time for us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And the Reverend Todd Urey, Senior Pastor of Douglas Memorial Church. Always great to
good
have
to be
you,
with
my
you,
friend.
Friend.
And Dr. Maricela Gomez, physician, community activist, who wrote the book Race, Class, Power, and Organizing in East Baltimore, Rebuilding Communities in America. Always great to have you in our studio.
Thank you,
Mark.
Honor
to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
We'll take a very brief break and come back when we do. It's time to talk to another one of our mayoral candidates. Nick Mosby will be in the house. Stay with us.